Should be the notes with the, well, I don't even know what you have on the first page, but it says, page 6 at the top, it says Lecture 4, Atheism. And what we're going to try to do today is look at atheism, which Sire refers to as naturalism. We're going to break it down into 5 different types of atheism, although all of them would fall under the category of naturalism, but we'll look at it from the standpoint of naturalism, Marxism, nihilism, existentialism, and secular humanism. By the way, I need to get these handouts to you. We'll be referring to these notes here on Nietzsche, Sartre, Marx. I'm going to make it a little bit easier so you don't have to write a million words a minute there. So let's look first at naturalism. Hopefully you have the, you find this page because the notes are already written. I'm just summing. What's that? On mine it's worldviews, which doesn't always mean the same thing for you. It's should be right behind the page on deism. Pages on deism. And so, hopefully you'll... That? Good, good. Okay, on naturalism, Sire deals with this on pages 54 to 64. And the first point there is naturalism basically is a rejection of the supernatural. Only nature exists. Okay, so matter alone exists. There is no God. Point number two there under naturalism is that the universe is a uniformity of cause and effect in a closed system. Now, what do you think Sire means by a closed system there in reference to naturalism? Yeah, well, and what he's talking about is he used the illustration of the box. Within the box of nature, where only natural causes exist, there's nothing outside the box. There's no door to the box that opens up to the outside so that something that transcends nature, supernatural, can intervene. So what he means by a closed system, it's closed to the outside because there is no outside. So rather than an open system, which in this sense would mean, viewing the universe as an open system would mean that the universe is open to intervention from the outside. In other words, miracles can take place. An outside entity, i.e. God, who exists apart from the universe, can intervene. And this idea of saying no miracles, the universe is a closed system, there's nothing but the universe, the physical universe. Therefore, all causes are natural causes. There are no supernatural causes. Because of this, human beings are viewed as merely as complex machines. And, you know, some former atheists are now starting to acknowledge that, you know, it dawned on them eventually that even complex machines need machine makers. So you still need a designer. You don't escape the need for an intelligent designer by calling man a machine. Point number four, death is extinction. When you die, you cease to exist. Okay, no life after death. Number five, since there's no life after death, no God, no punishments and rewards, ultimately, history is without purpose, which is really weird because, you know, the leading naturalist, the leading atheist, always try to make the world of today and the world of tomorrow a better place to live. Well, why? If when the universe dies, everything's going to die with it, why battle to make the world a better place to live? I mean, if human history is without purpose, then the role that a particular atheist plays in human history is as meaningless as the entire history put together.
No.
Rain of fire? No. I think I saw coming attractions to it.
Yeah. But the whole time I was thinking about, these people are all about evolution, the fact that this all came about. So my question would be, why would they fight for it? Why would they fight campaign like they're battling for what's right, but how they know it's right?
Oh, did the people in the movie?
Yeah.
Oh, in that particular movie? Yeah.
Yeah.
And then we're going to read a little bit of a parable of Friedrich Nietzsche when we get to nihilism. And, Nietzsche's, trying to remind his fellow atheists that, look, if God doesn't exist, then there's no meaning, no purpose. So stop living. You reject Christianity, you trample on Christianity, and then you live like nothing changed, like Christianity is still true, or like you still believe it's true. And so he tells them to be more consistent. But in the end, what does Nietzsche do? Nietzsche proposes his own myth. So, there's no good, there's no evil, there's no dragon to be slayed, but in the end, let's invent the dragon to be slayed because we need a dragon to be slayed, otherwise life isn't worth living. So even Nietzsche proposes his own myth. So I believe Nietzsche was the most consistent atheist who ever lived, but he still wasn't consistent because it's impossible to be consistent. But at least he was consistent enough to acknowledge that his views were not rational. His views were volitional and passionate. And in other words, you throw God out the window, reason and truth go out the window with him, so then all that's left is man's will to power. So at least he acknowledges that my myth isn't true, but we like it, we want it, we're going to go get it. Even that is contradictory. And so I think just to get out of bed in the morning and try to make something out of yourself and your life, try to help others, assumes that the universe makes sense, which assumes that it has a rational cause, which assumes that there's a reasonable God. And you can reject the existence of the rational God of the Bible, but you still have to live as if he exists. Also, their view is that ethics is not based in God, the whole discipline of right and wrong, it's not based in God, and so atheists spend an awful lot of time trying to argue how there could be such a thing as right and wrong when in reality there's no God in their view. And believe me, there has never been a good solid explanation how a particular act could be really right or really wrong in the ultimate sense of the word if there is no God. So atheists usually settle for something less than that. We would all like this to be right, so it's right. It's, mob rules. And now the refutation of naturalism, okay, the way I would refute it is the cumulative case for God. And I don't know, if you have the Theism versus Atheism book, my debate with Dr. Michael Martin, if you look on page 1, I'm just going to read a paragraph there and then a couple paragraphs from my conclusion, just to summarize my argument. Now, we already went over my cumulative case for God, the different arguments, okay? I don't use just one argument. I use a lot of different arguments. I don't put all my eggs in one basket. And we already went over that, but I just want to refresh your memory by reading these paragraphs. So on page one in my opening statement, second paragraph in the introduction, I state this: I have decided not to rest my case for the existence of a personal infinite God on the validity of one sole argument. Instead, I have chosen to utilize a cumulative case for God. This cumulative case will examine nine different aspects of human experience, we actually used, I believe, 13, that are more adequately explained by theism, the belief in a personal God, than by atheism, the rejection of the belief in a personal God. The thesis I seek to defend is as follows: it is more reasonable to be a theist than it is to be an atheist. Now, if you turn over to page 14, at the very bottom, the conclusion there, and then on to page 15, I state this: in the famous debate on the existence of God between Bertrand Russell and Frederick Copleston, the atheist Bertrand Russell stated concerning the existence of the universe, "I should say that the universe is just there, and that's all." It is my contention that atheism fails as an explanation of significant aspects of human experience, and that theism is a more reasonable hypothesis. If the atheist could say that the universe is just there, could he not say that moral values, design and order, universal truth, the human experience of guilt, sanctity of human life, the possibility of human knowledge and meaning in life are just there as well? To avoid looking for an explanation is not the same thing as the search for an explanation. In this sense, the theistic explanation is superior to the atheistic explanation, for the latter reduces to a non-explanation. You know, instead it's explaining away. Actually, not explaining away, but you're saying, oh yeah, those things are there, but they're just there. Don't look for a cause. Well, they're excess baggage for the atheistic worldview. However, the atheist may choose to deny the reality of moral values, design and order, universal truths, the human experience of guilt, the sanctity of human life, the possibility of human knowledge, and meaning in life. If the atheist takes this strategy, my response is that he can't live consistently with the view that these things are not real. Even the atheist lives as if some things are wrong and other things are right. He lives as if human life is sacred and life has meaning. So you can deny these obvious aspects of human experience if you're an atheist, but then you can't live consistently with them. Or you can acknowledge these aspects of human experience as real, but then atheism has no explanation. They're just there. And if your answer to the most widely recognized aspects of human experience are, well, they're just there. They're just there. Well, that's not an explanation. And a worldview, by definition, is an explanation. So if your worldview turns into a non-explanation, it's a lousy worldview. In fact, it's a kind of an anti-worldview masquerading as a worldview. And so keep in mind, when we covered evidence for God's existence, the arguments for God's existence, on each one of those you might say, yeah, well, this particular argument doesn't prove God's existence with logical necessity. Yeah, but look at the alternative. Is it, since moral laws are there, I mean, you know, what are the options? There are no absolute moral laws. Well, nobody can live consistently with that. So then we say, okay, absolute moral laws exist. Is it more reasonable to believe that there's an absolute moral lawgiver from which they come? Or that the absolute moral laws are just there? When you look at those three options, I think it's clear that the theistic hypothesis, the theistic explanation, is much more plausible than the atheistic explanation. And you can go right down the line: the beginning of the universe, the continuing existence of the universe, universal unchanging truths, meaning in life, and point after point, theism proves itself to be far superior to atheism. So when refuting naturalism, I would turn to what I call the cumulative case for God, and we covered that earlier when we defended theism. Now, later on tonight, hopefully we'll have time to talk about the problem of evil, which is atheism's biggest argument against theism, against the existence of a personal God, and a little bit about creation versus evolution. Now, entire books can be written about those topics, entire courses can be taught on those topics, so we're not going to be able to do them justice, but hopefully we'll be able to spend a little bit of time on that. So let's move on to a type of naturalism or a type of atheism called Marxism. There's a page where I have communism, and I talk about Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels from the Communist Manifesto, and it's really a complex, wild, weird view of reality that Marx had. Top of the page, it says the bourgeoisie, they're the capitalists, the business owners. They're the bad guys, okay, in Marx's way of thinking. Marx sees everything. He's an atheist who sees everything in terms of economics, okay? Sin is replaced by this evil capitalist business owner class who through profit are ripping off the workers, okay? And the proletariat, they are the working class, okay? Now, in Hegel's thought, okay, Hegel was an idealist. And by that, what I mean is he was an idealist in the sense where only ideas exist. The first physical world isn't really real. Only ideas exist. So he viewed everything in terms, and especially history, in terms of ideas. You'll have an idea, the thesis, okay? And it will be opposed by an antithesis, okay? Now, or antithesis, opposing view. Actually, in Hegel's thought, there could be many different, opposing views, okay? And the end result would be, actually the way I should put it, would be the thesis down here, and the antithesis, and they battle it out, two opposing ideas, okay, and then you end up with a synthesis, okay. You can see there's some truth to this, by the way, even in this oversimplification of Hegel. Hegel's thought, by the way, is more complex. He didn't see everything in list of in terms of this triad. See, in other words, the synthesis would become a new what? A new thesis. And so you start all over again. There'd be a new antithesis. And so then you get a new synthesis. Well, guess what? And then it goes on from there. Now, keep in mind, Hegel's thought, it wasn't this simplistic. There was an obscure German philosopher who oversimplified, and I don't even remember his name, most philosophers don't remember his name, he oversimplified Hegel's thought into this triadic system, okay? Hegel denies it in the preface of one of his books, that he doesn't hold to this simple view here, but Karl Marx got his views of Hegel through this German philosopher, so he had this oversimplified view of Hegel. But whatever the case, even with this simple, oversimplified view of Hegel, you can see this in the history of ideas. You can see something like this going on, where the Greek philosophers would focus on being, that which remains the same. And then others would focus on that which changes, or the act of becoming. So you would have the thesis being, the antithesis becoming, and then the synthesis would be somebody who arrives on the scene and says, well, there are things that remain the same, but they go through change. And so you have being and becoming. The views get synthesized and all. But in Hegel's thought, we had never arrived at truth, at absolute truth, that the thesis isn't absolutely true, the antithesis isn't absolutely true, because they're synthesized to form a new truth, which isn't absolutely true, because it's the thing that which contradicts it ends up synthesizing with it, so it goes on and on. So basically, absolute truth is kind of God that is unfolding itself through history. So the history of evolution, keep in mind, Hegel sees evolution in the realm of ideas. Ideas changing, the unfolding of history, the unfolding of truth, okay? And so God is this historical process, this evolutionary process that occurs in the realm of ideas, not in the physical realm. And so with Marx and Engels, they held to the Hegelian dialectic, the unfolding of history, this unfolding process, okay? However, they combined it with Ludwig Feuerbach's materialism. He was an atheist. He was a naturalist. He believed that only physical things exist. Okay, so you combined it. They combined it with this. Okay, and so Marx was a big fan of Darwin, and he believed everything was evolving. And he saw everything in terms of economics. And so keep in mind, so he takes this dialectic. Now you can see in his view, you had like somewhat of a primitive communism, and the antithesis of that was slavery. They were synthesized by feudalism. The new antithesis was capitalism, you know, private ownership of property. And then that gets synthesized into communism, or what we would call socialism, and eventually you reach the utopian classless society. So he sees this unfolding. So, you know, there was a time when capitalism was fine, but those days are gone. There's an antithesis here, and it's going to be synthesized by this classless society. Again, economic determinism. He saw everything in terms of economics, this class struggle between the working class, the proletariat, and the bourgeoisie, the capitalists, the business owners, and that and everything was determined. We are going to reach the classless society no matter what. We're going to reach utopia no matter what. However, Marx believed we could speed up the process through revolution. Now, to be totally honest with you, that doesn't make sense. If everything is determined because all causes are natural and man isn't really free, then what makes us think that we're free to speed up the process through revolution? And again, I mentioned he held to Darwin's view of evolution and kind of the survival of the fittest mentality that kind of lends credence to the idea of revolution, the revolution of the working class. By the way, he believed that when the working class revolts and knocks off the capitalists, the bourgeoisie, that you would temporarily set up the dictatorship of the proletariat, the dictatorship of the working class. Now, how in the world can you imagine taking the huge working class in America and supposing we conquered our bosses? And believe me, I don't want to declare war on the guy who signs my paycheck, but Marx thought I should. And he thought profit was evil. But profit is what drives, what motivates entrepreneurs to start businesses, which then creates jobs for us. And the idea that, you know, the working class is going to do it on its own is just not going to happen. But whatever the case, can you imagine if the working class in America overthrew the business owners? How in the world is that working class, millions upon millions of workers, how are we going to have form our own dictatorship temporarily until we usher in utopian classless society? It's not going to happen. And number one, whoever controls the reins of power, because of the fall of mankind, which did happen, contrary to what Marx believes, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Our founding fathers understood that. Whoever controls the reins of power is never going to give it up. So whoever controls that dictatorship, you know, those tyrants aren't going to give up power. That's number one. It's just a pipe dream to think they're going to. You have to deny the fall in order to assume that somehow, you know, I mean, if the capitalists are going to enslave the working class, according to Marx, what makes them think the working class is going to just start enslaving those who are under them? But the second thing is, how do you even do that? Do you end up voting in representatives? You know, I mean, you can't have 250 million dictators. So, you know, how does it come about? And the way all Marxist communist regimes have done this is, rather than the dictatorship of the proletariat to represent the working class, you get the professional revolutionaries. The guys who led the revolution, they're the guys who get to become the dictators. After all, they're representing the working class. Well, guess what? These guys never really worked. There's no dirt under their fingernails. In fact, if you look close enough, all you see is blood under their fingernails. These guys are professional terrorists, professional murderers, professional warriors, and they're just professional revolutionaries. They're wannabe dictators. If you think the capitalists, the greedy business owners, and by the way, we all are all greedy, but if you think they're evil, wait till the dictators take power. The Lenins and the Stalins. Stalins slaughtered tens of millions of his own people during peacetime. I mean, just the Soviet Union and Communist China alone in the 20th century slaughtered over 120 million of their own people during peacetime. That's more people than have died in the history of man's wars put together. In fact, it's a sad statement, but the nicest thing you can do for the people of, I don't recommend it, but the nicest thing you could do for the people of a communist regime living under a communist dictatorship is invade them. Because then the government has to enlist them in the military and arm them so at least they have a fighting chance. But it's during peacetime, when a communist regime is not at war, more people die. Their own people, the government declares war, you know, and you can't, well, this guy's had a college-level economics course. He knows what capitalism is. Let's kill him. He knows too much. And, oh, yeah, and this guy's a Christian. And so he believes in authority above our dictatorship. Let's kill him. You know, and, oh, we heard from so-and-so, who heard from so-and-so, that he badmouthed our government. Let's stick him in Siberia, in a prison camp. You know, and the list goes on and on. So, but this, you know, survival of the fittest mentality. Marx referred to religion in his writings as the opium of the people. In other words, religion is the narcotic, kind of the hallucinogenic drug, or at least the drug that dopes us up to the point that we can ignore the pain. You know, the business owners are putting whips to the working man's back, okay? And what religion does is it makes us say, you know what? The 50 lashes I'm receiving today aren't that bad, because as long as I'm a good little worker, God's going to give me everlasting joy after I die. And so Marx's view of religion was that it just drugs us up. So it just keeps the working class from revolting. Okay? And you know, there is a sense where sometimes we Christians, maybe we're not angry enough. I don't think we should do violent things because of it. But maybe we're not angry enough about abortion and infanticide, the killing of babies already born. And maybe we're not angry enough about immoral people forcing their values on us. And so sometimes we do take even true religion, true Christianity, and use it as, well, life stinks, and the government's getting so big it wants to steal my children from me, and they want to indoctrinate my children and teach them to oppose me, oppose my values. But even if they steal my kids from me, in the end, I'll live forever in heaven. So there's an element of truth in that. Not so much what religion is, like Marx thought, but what we sometimes, even true believers, what we sometimes make out of religion. And, you know, the expression that we can be too heavenly minded to be of any earthly good. I think that's a fallacy, because if we really are heavenly minded, like Paul tells us to be in Ephesians 1, and we really do focus on our spiritual blessings in the heavenly places in Christ, it will cause us to be very earthly minded. In other words, it will cause us to impact our world. But there is kind of a pseudo heavenly minded type of thinking that really gives ammunition to a Marxist type argument there. But you know, what Marx is saying is what John Lennon said. You know, imagine there's no heaven. You know, imagine there's no hell. And then he starts arguing that we could all come together and live in peace. No, you know, there's guys who, if they thought there was no heaven and no hell, they would try to slaughter anybody who disagrees with them. So, I mean, it just does not follow. Imagine there's no heaven, no hell, there's no life, no God, no life after death, and that's going to make us live together in peace? No. I think that's just going to lead to chaos. You know, if a 6'6", 285-pound, muscle-bound, if I stall in the middle of nowhere on some road, and all of a sudden a 6'6", 285-pound, muscle-bound biker pulls up on a Harley, okay, it's going to make a difference to me that he's got a Jesus Saves tattoo on his 22-inch bicep rather than a swastika on his bicep, okay? I want to know. I would feel reassured to know that the biker who stopped because I got a flat tire, that biker believes there is a heaven and a hell. I'd feel a little bit better than if he believed there's no heaven and no hell. Hey, if there's no... He doesn't believe in heaven or hell, he might not just want to live together in peace with me. But if he acknowledges the existence of a God infinitely more powerful than him, you know, then he might go light on me. And and might even try to help me out. Marx believed private property must be abolished. I once worked in on a police department where a lady police officer was arguing against me in favor of Marxism, communism, because she had just enough college to be dumbed down from some obvious facts of human life. It was really sad, but she said, "Well, I like to sum up communism in one word: sharing." You know, and there's two ways you can respond to it. One way you can respond to it is, well, if you just look at the history of the 20th century, you could actually sum up communism in one word: slaughter. Because that's what has led to the slaughter of human beings. But the way Karl Marx summed it up, he comes right out and sums up communism in one phrase: the abolition of private property, or the abolition of private ownership. See, sharing, what is sharing? Sharing is like the Book of Acts. If you have some land, you could sell it and give the money to the poor. But you can't share what you don't own. Christianity deals with sharing. Share what you have with others less fortunate than yourself. Communism is not sharing. Communism, a dictatorship, takes what you have earned, what you've worked hard for. They take it and they distribute it as they feel led, which usually means members of the Communist Party are rich and live in mansions, and everybody else lives on the scraps from the table, even though they're the ones who worked hard to produce whatever it is that the communists are living high off of. But Karl Marx believed private property should be abolished. See, this is why it is so messed up, our welfare system today. If I'm hungry and I need some money or some food, okay? If I'm hungry and I ask James for a dollar, okay? If you give me a dollar, at least I get a dollar, okay? Now, if the government takes a dollar from James, by the time it gets to me, I'll be lucky to get a nickel. So, number one, it's not cost-effective, because you've got all these paper pushers that got to be paid, and then all that paper that's got to be paid for, and so that dollar turns into 5 cents. That's number one. Number two, James is going to think, now, wait a minute, this is my hard-earned money. Why should I give this Fernandez guy a dollar? He might go out and buy a beer with it, or buy some dope. So let me take him down the street to McDonald's and buy him a hamburger. Okay? Because that's your hard-earned money. Once the government takes it from you, you know, so the redistribution of wealth is, you know, that's stealing. That's not the right way to do it. And we actually ought to encourage people to give, rather than, you know, when the government, the churches get their money, which a certain amount of that money should be going to try to help people in need. Churches get their money voluntarily from people. It's called charity. The government gets its money through coercion. Okay? And government was intended for a limited role, and when it goes beyond that, things get ugly. A lot of people don't even realize, but Karl Marx taught that the family should be abolished. He agreed with Plato that the state is better equipped to educate the children and to should be responsible for the children. We're seeing this happen today, where, granted, I want the government, if somebody is beating their child, okay, I want the government to be able to step in and rescue that child. I want police to show up and rescue that child. And I don't think it's a good idea. I think Ellen Krasnow hit the nail on the head. Why punish the child? If there's a mother and a father, and daddy is brutal to the child, why yank the child out of the home? It's a perfectly good parent there. why do you yank the child away and imprison the child in a foster care system that doesn't work? So who should be yanked from the home? Daddy, he's the thug. So, but there's this big push where, you know, who owns the children? And right now, it's getting to the point where, you know, if a bruise shows up on your child, you're guilty till proven innocent. And if your child fell off a swing and you can't prove it, your child is liable to go, you know, by working in law enforcement. A guy who was putting his cigarettes out in his 12-year-old mentally disabled daughter's arms, he got his child back because he said, told Child Protective Services, oh yeah, I won't spank my kids at all. So he gets his child back, the alcoholic that puts his cigarettes out in the kid's arms. But the Christian parent who didn't hit the child got a bruise from falling off a swing, but the parents couldn't prove it. Because they say, no, we're Christians, and we believe if our children need a spanking, we're going to give them a spanking. Sometimes they don't get their kids back, because there's a power thing. You know, so the whole issue is it's not like the child's best interests are at stake. It's the state is saying, look, if you genuflect, you get your kids back. If you don't bow before us, we keep the kids. And so it's really getting scary, really getting ugly there. I tell my people at church, I'll, Rahab the harlot lied through her teeth to the governing authorities to protect the innocent lives. They just did not deserve the truth. God commends her for that lie to save innocent human life throughout the scriptures. And so I tell my people, you tell a child, you know, if you're being a good parent, you know that you're being a good parent, and you're not going too far, tell Child Protective Services whatever they want to hear and just get them out of your child's life, you know? Yeah, it's really, really sad. But Marsh believed the state must raise and educate the children. Let me tell you, do you think that Jesus and the apostles, That Jesus would encourage the apostles to send their kids to the Roman pagans for a good education, good government-run education? No. He believed that the parents, the scriptures teach, the parents are responsible for the education that their children receive, and what the parents usually did was they did that within the context of their religion, the biblical faith. So just like the Jewish Orthodox Jews will set up Jewish schools and all. But the idea, when the state takes over education, the best interests of the child are no longer there. Instead, the state begins to indoctrinate the children in political correctness to protect the interests of the state. And that's exactly what's happening in our public school system. A lot of big gray area here. My own view on a public school system is I think we need to fight to try to win back the public schools, okay? But in the meantime, I would rather not my kids be there, okay? So in other words, while we're trying to patch the holes in a sinking ship, I'd rather my kids be on a ship that's floating. And the sad thing is there's a lot of Christian schools that, you know, in order for teachers to be state certified, they've got to receive their training under John Dewey, the father of modern education, who signed Humanist Manifesto number 1. A lot of times the Christian schools aren't much different. And so it's sad, but I think if parents can handle it, and not all parents can, sometimes I think homeschooling is the best way to go. But it's not for everybody. It takes a lot of commitment. But whatever the case, Marx also argued for a utopia, a classless society. You know, in the end, you get this classless society, it would be total anarchy. There'd be no government. You know, this denies man's fall and the need for government. God instituted human government because we need to be policed. Okay? the good thing about the government our founding fathers formed is they figured out ways to police the government, too. It was a self-policing government. So the government not only polices the people, but the people are able to police the government. And you have three branches of government fighting it out with each other. And the separation of powers between the federal government, the state government, the local governments. So basically, it's a self-policing system so that if we stuck to the Constitution, no one entity in our government would gain so much power that it could just unleash its tyranny on the unsuspecting masses. Unfortunately, we've fallen a long way. And then Marx argues for a one-world government. Workers of the world unite. You have nothing to lose but your chains. And of course, that's just right back at the Tower of Babel. Now, let me just go over a few of the 10 planks of the Communist Manifesto. Marx argued that, nevertheless, in the most advanced countries, the following will be pretty generally applicable. Number one, abolition of property in land, okay, and all application of all rents of land to public purposes. So basically, more and more land going to the government